The court will proceed to the second case of the day, Gross versus AIDS Research. Mr. Mammo?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I represent the relator, Dr. Sanford Gross, in this case, who was a participant during 1988 and 1999 in a National Institutes of Health funded study of a drug called Proleukin. That drug had been approved as an end-stage cancer drug. It was highly toxic, and this particular study had a very small cohort, a sample size of about 460 patients. Time permitting today, if it pleases the court, I intend to briefly discuss the regulatory environment that these claims arose in, the materiality of the regulations that have been violated, and the false claims.
Well, what's the false claim exactly?
What is the false claim, Your Honor?
Yeah.
Your Honor, the false claims exist in the the forms that were cited in the Second Amended complaint, which were filed throughout the time that Dr. Gross was in this study in order to obtain funding on a periodic basis. They are the forms.
So what would be an example of a what would be the clearest example for you of the false claim, of a false claim?
Your Honor, what we have are non-disclosures in this case and the false certifications in the forms that indicated
well, give me
that they
something
are
concrete. Okay, what's an example, a false claim that you're, you know, complaining about?
Your Honor, concrete examples are
just one example.
All right. The IRB, the Institutional Review Board here, changed the informed consent forms and gave no notification to the.
Well, wait, I'm lost. What's IRB?
Institutional Review Board. That is Catholic Health Partners in this
well,
case.
All right.
Your Honor.
So be concrete. So you say. So what did the Catholic Health Partners falsely certify?
They certified that they had complied with all of the regulations that governed this, including good clinical practices, which are under 21 CFR parts 50 and 56.
And they did this, what, in order to get another installment of the government money?
Correct, Your Honor. They had to certify at least annually in order to obtain the next allotment of money. In this particular case, there was a programmatic allotment of money. They may have approved $3.7 million over the period of the study. However, annually, a new budget and a progress report in these forms 2590 had to be filed and the certifications again made in order to take the next allotment. So $3.7 million was not made available all at one time.
But instead, now, are you trying to get back, you know, for the government, I suppose, and then you get a piece of it, the whole $3.7 million or just the part that was dispersed after these false certifications?
Your Honor, we would be seeking the entire $3.7 million, I expect, after discovery, because the types of regulatory violations that occurred here were ones which undermined what the government was buying. There was no scientific value to it.
But I don't understand that, because I understand how you make someone makes a false claim of money and says to the government, you know, I want my annual installment of $1 million, and I certify this. I mean, that's very straightforward. But what about reaching back? Because suppose they get the original award, $3.7 million. They get that without any false claims. Then after they've gotten it, after they got the first payment, they start, you know, false claiming. But why would that first payment be the product of a false claim?
Because it is a study, the results of which continue to build upon the existing results they have. In other words, they continue to roll forward and take the additional information they have gotten as participants continue in the study over a period of time, and then at the conclusion of the study, they publish the results, which are a blend now of all the experience they have had.
I don't understand that. I mean, suppose they get the first $1 million, no false claims, nothing. Then they, you know, screw up. So you can see how the government would want to get its money back. I understand that. But the money wouldn't have been obtained by a false claim the way the subsequent installments were.
The first installment would not have been at the time it was given. However, what happens is that the subsequent false claims, which begin to undermine the integrity of all the data in the study, essentially renders all of the funding subject to recapture. Because
recaptured, but is it the product of a false claim, that first installment? It wasn't procured by a false claim.
The first installment at the time it was procured,
right.
Your Honor, I think Your Honor's correct.
Which is what we usually think of as fraud. You know, it's a misrepresentation that gets you something. It's different from embezzlement, right?
I think it is. But this is a cumulative study, Your Honor.
I don't get the cumulative. I don't understand. I thought it's just a false claim statute. It's not a general... You know, maybe it is, but if false claim requires a misrepresentation, you got money because of a misrepresentation, they didn't get that first installment because of a misrepresentation, only the subsequent installments.
I'm agreed, Your Honor. I think that the only point that I make to try to clarify our position on that is that because of the subsequent scientific misconduct and false statements about it, all of the money that the government paid to generate the cumulative data in the study was of no value to it.
But how do you fit that into the statute? What is the provision that says that if you render, if you do something that renders the government's the government's project valueless, that permits a false claim? Action.
Well, Your Honor, the statute, I think, looks at the false statement or certification at the time.
Where is this?
I'm
what
sorry?
What is the critical statutory language?
Your Honor, I think that it's simply in the part of Section 3729 that talks about knowingly making, using, or causing to be made or used a false record or statement to get a false or fraudulent claim paid or
precisely
approved.
And I don't see how it also, you know, defrauding the government by presenting a false claim for payment. Well, when they presented their first claim for the payment of the first installment, that wasn't false. The bad things happened later.
Well, Your Honor may be anticipating.
Your
Honor may be anticipating where some of the issues in this case head, but certainly for the project period that was affected by the false statements, that amount, which we don't yet have discovery of, will become, we think, subject to recapture at a minimum. I think that there is a reasonable argument as well that when you've tainted the entire study, then the government's entire investment has been rendered valueless by the fraud.
But this isn't a taint or valueless statute. It doesn't say anything about that. It's just getting payment on the basis of a false or fraudulent claim. Paid or approved by the government. It seems very limited. Make this seem a general statute. Anytime the government gets cheated, you can have a false claims act.
Your Honor, if the government is attempting to buy a research product and the scientific misconduct that occurs in the course of it renders the entire amounts that have been spent.
But this is not a statute about scientific misconduct. It's about submitting a claim to the government that's false and getting paid or approved. And therefore, and unless they intended bad things when they got the first installment, that first installment was not pursuant to a false claim.
I think that's true, Your Honor. I think that the false claims here, though, themselves cloak the scientific misconduct.
So what's this cloaking stuff? Cloak, taint? That's
failed.
Not in the statute, any of
it's
that.
It's a non-disclosure, Your Honor. It's a certification.
It's not in the statute.
Well, I think that it is
cloaking.
It is
statute.
in the statute in the manner in which it's being interpreted, which is much like any other false statement. A statement can be made false directly or by omission of information that should have been included in it to make it accurate. And so this is a case where, at a minimum, we have omissions to
not
set
before
forth.
The first installment was paid.
Not before the first installment that we've found so far, Your Honor. I agree with that. We do have them, though, with respect to subsequent installments that came at the point and after the point that Dr. Gross participated in the study. Your Honor, and if it pleases the Court, I want to address the materiality of these regulations briefly. Again, as I think has become clear during the course of the questioning, the funds are taken down either monthly or quarterly and require at least annual recertifications, new budget projections, progress reports.
Was that alleged in the complaint?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Did you allege those things in the complaint?
Yes, we did, Your Honor. I think if the Court focuses on paragraph 66 especially in the second amended complaint, we have alleged the continuing nature of the certifications that had to be made.
I know that there are some general allegations to that effect. Did you allege what you specifically just now represented to the Court in your second amended complaint?
Your Honor,
that there were monthly, I think you said, and quarterly and annual payments made.
Not with the level of specificity I just stated to the Court. Your Honor, we cited in our second amended complaint many of the forms and the regulations that were required to be complied with, which do provide, as I'm now more explicitly stating.
There's a great deal of detail in the second amended complaint about the forms that were required, but there is very little detail, I think no detail, about the payment schedule or the payment terms of this grant. All it alleges in extremely general terms is that the certifications were material to continued receipt of funds.
Your Honor, we did
that.
That's about it. I think we did that by reference, which obviously did not serve us well here, because I think that was one of the areas where the trial court struggled to appreciate the significance of what we were contending were the false claims and the false certifications. The Court notes in footnotes throughout its opinion that we cited all these forms and regulations, but the Court doesn't appreciate or doesn't see the materiality or relevance of the forms. We've tried to make that more plain now in our briefing here, but I think that we did it by reference. It required, unfortunately, I think, that the Court would have gone out and read all those regulations quite carefully. We've attempted to do that a little more completely in our briefing here so that it's plainer. But I think that all of those allegations were fundamentally in the second amended complaint because we did incorporate the regulatory framework and the common rule standards and so on that had to be complied with by all the defendants. But I think that that's key then to what we contend are the errors of the trial court in reaching the decision it finally did to dismiss this case. The court applied the rationale of this court's decision in, I'll call it the Lamers case. I'm not sure if I'm butchering
right.
The pronunciation, but I apologize if I am.
Well, that's correct.
Your Honor, in that case, the court, much like the Ninth Circuit had in the Hopper case, referred to technical requirements. And while I am the first to admit that there is a very dense regulatory structure in which this claim arises, I think that the term technical noncompliance is used differently in Lamers and the other decisions that are similar to it, and that is in the sense of obscure, not regulations that are fundamental or particularly material, and thus there is no reason in that context, like in Lamers, that one would be able to infer knowledge of violation. Here, our regulations are fundamental. They are at the forefront of the human research protections and the scientific protections that are required for expenditures by the National Institutes of Health, much different than the types of funding that were involved in Lamers. So, Your Honor, I think that the Lamers approach does not apply here. It does not, that the rationale of that case doesn't fit, because we have a reasonable inference of knowledge by virtue of the materiality of these regulations and the conditioning of further funding on compliance with the regulatory scheme every time they went back for more money. Your Honor, I can see that I'm into my rebuttal period, and so I will stop at this point unless the Court has something else it'd like me to address now.
Thank you, Mr. Mallon. Mr. Ruggieri?
May it please the Court. I'm Michael Breer with Lord Bissell and Brook. I'm here on behalf of the appellees, the AIDS Research Alliance, and the individual physicians and the nurse defendant, and I'm also joined by Mr. David Honig, who represents Catholic Health Partners. I'd like to return to a question that was asked of the appellant regarding where is the false claim. I would submit to you there is no false claim alleged in the Second Amendment complaint.
I don't understand that. If there's a required certification of compliance with regulations, and that's a prerequisite to another installment, then if you say it's false because they didn't comply, why isn't that alleging a false claim?
Your Honor, the premise of your question was that certification was a prerequisite to the payment, to
right.
some further payment.
Right.
First of all, there was nothing cited. There are no allegations in here that say the compliance with the regulations.
Well, now wait a minute. I mean, if you're required to submit all these certifications before you get the installment, isn't it pretty clear that they're a prerequisite?
The certification, you must sign the certification, Your Honor. But
well, it has to be true also.
Yes, but the violation of the regulations, if you violate a regulation, that is not what the payment is contingent upon, which is what courts have repeatedly rejected, is when relators have attempted to turn the False Claims Act.
I don't understand you. If you're violating their regulations, they're not going to give you another installment.
I do not believe that's true, Your Honor. In fact, if you look at the Lammers case, it expressly details.
Well, I mean, if it's trivial and so on, but some of their claims, you know, about the dosage that Gross was permitted to adjust his dosage, and that you know he took prednisone and so on, and that's serious. That certainly would undermine the value of the study. If you have someone taking other drugs and so on, or taking the wrong dosage, then it's very difficult to measure the effect of the drug. So why isn't that potentially serious?
Your Honor, I believe it is potentially serious, but
right.
it's not material to the government's decision.
I don't understand that. Suppose you say to the government, you know, we'd like your next $1 million. Well, actually, you know, we admit we haven't been regulating the dosage. We haven't been preventing these people from taking drugs that you know screw up the study. But we'd still like our $1 million. Well, obviously, they're not going to get it.
Well, I don't believe it's true that obviously they're not going to get it.
Well, maybe it's not 100%, but it's certainly material. The government wants to know if the grantees are conducting a proper study. And if they aren't, if they're not in particular, they're not making sure that the subjects in the study are taking the prescribed dosage and not more, not with drugs that interact with the drug being tested, then the government is quite likely not to continue paying.
Again, I would disagree with that premise, Your Honor, because the government in this case, as well as in the Lammers decision, has a system in place to address regulatory violations and non-compliance issues. In that circumstance, the government typically goes in, identifies the regulation, and gives the entity the opportunity, actually demands that the entity
fix it. Well, that sounds like an issue for trial. That is, were these violations, maybe they're the sort of thing that happened in all these studies, unavoidable and so on, government takes a forgiving look. Isn't it, why isn't it a triable issue how material these false certifications were?
Well, Your Honor, to get past this stage, there has to be a false claim that relates to something that would be material to
yes,
the government's decision.
Yes, well, a false certification of compliance with important regulatory limitations could be material.
Again, Your Honor, you have to look at what the false certification allegedly is. And in this circumstance, I do not believe we have a false claim. And the regulations that are claimed to have been violated here respecting Dr. Gross's personal medical attention, there we have not seen, and I do not believe the relator has shown anywhere that violations of those regulations were dependent upon or would negate getting money from the National Institute of Health for this grant. What the relator wants the court to do is to turn the False Claims Act into a means by which for any regulatory violation.
No, not any regulatory, serious regulatory violation.
That's not what the Second Amendment complaint alleges, Your Honor, and that's not where they are trying to get at. It's not a serious regulatory violation.
I don't understand you. Failure to maintain constant dosage in your subjects sounds serious to me. And if you falsely certify that you're doing that and you're not, well, that's what it means, say it's false, that could very well cause the government to stop the funding.
Perhaps it could, Your Honor, but it also, more likely, as is cited in the NIH guidelines that are in the record, I believe in the record at 35.
You say perhaps, but I don't understand how a complaint can be dismissed on its face with all these open questions about the gravity of these violations. And it's not just the gravity of the violations, it's the significance of a false certification. It's one thing to violate a regulation. It's another thing to certify that you're not violating the regulation.
If we could get back then to the issue of the false certification, Your Honor, there are no allegations in here of a false certification that resulted in a wrongful payment from the government. The only allegation in here in the Second Amendment complaint regarding funding is in paragraph 21 of the Second Amendment complaint, which references the $3.7 million that was paid out to the AIDS Research Alliance for work on this study as well as in some other studies. There are no allegations, as was pointed out to the court previously, regarding this continuation of payments argument that has only been raised in the appellate briefings. The Second Amendment complaint does not allege that there were subsequent payments made and there were subsequent false certifications that resulted in payments. It only alleges this initial one, which, Your Honor, you keyed in on when you were questioning the relator's counsel. And I would direct or respectfully request the court to direct their attention to the appellant's brief at page 23, where they admit the alleged violations in conducting this study occurred after the human subjects in the study had been enrolled, which of course is after the grant was awarded and after this money was awarded.
The money wasn't paid. Up front.
Your Honor, I don't see anywhere in the complaint, Second Amendment complaint, that's been alleged.
Well, I mean, really, we know that there was a requirement of annual certification.
Yes, Your Honor, but
that was a condition preceding to getting the money.
No, we don't know that that was a condition preceding to getting that, whatever portion of that $3.7 million may have related to this study and not to other studies. We don't have any clue of how much that is.
You think it's
or when
zero?
That was paid.
You think for this study they paid it all in advance? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying we don't know that, Your Honor.
You don't know
and
it.
We don't know
not
what
alleged?
The we don't know what it's not alleged. And there's no total amount here that relates to the study. And therefore, if we're going to look at an alleged false claim in this Second Amended complaint, we have to find where the claim is, what's false and what supposedly was paid in reliance on a claim that was supposedly knowingly falsely made and had and was material to the decision as far as whether or not that should be paid, that money should be paid from the government. And again, I would refer the court to this court's decision in the Lammers case, in which there were regulatory violations that were pointed out, and the regulatory agency allowed and did what it typically does, asked for the entity to fix the violations, demanded that they be fixed, and once they were fixed, continued with the funding of the program. That's no different than what would happen here. Again, if you look at in the record a document that relates to the, that is one part of the NIH policies that the relator argues extensively in its briefs should give some justification for this continuing payment allegation. It specifically says that for enforcement actions, the entity is going to be advised of what the regulatory violations are, and in most cases, given an opportunity to cure them. And that's before any decision may be made regarding whether to withhold future awards, whether to withhold future funding. And that policy, and granted, it's not a statute, it's not a regulation, it's the policy that they're relying on, doesn't even say that they're going to cut off funding entirely for a regulatory violation. It's going to assess the situation and allow it to continue.
Is that even in the complaint?
It's no, ma'am. It's not in the complaint. It's in the record that was attached to their briefing and is referenced in their briefing in this.
Confined to what's in the Second Amendment complaint,
ma'am,
for purposes of this review.
It's not in the Second Amendment complaint. Again, there is not a false claim alleged there.
As I see this, this is an effort to fit a government grant case that is not premised on a false or fraudulent grant application, but allegedly false or fraudulent or inaccurate subsequent certifications into the False Claims Statute, subsection 2. And in order to do that, the allegations have to plead with some particularity a false or fraudulent certification that renders a government payment subsequently made itself false or fraudulent.
I agree with you. And as we have stated in the cross-appeal portion of our brief, we do not believe that there has been any false claim alleged with particularity, certainly not the particularity required by Rule 9B or the cases attendant to it. The First Amendment complaint, which was dismissed, was reworked by the relator simply by adding this FDA letter from 2002 and incorporating, frankly, irrelevant comments in it regarding Catholic Health Partners and what other entities may have been doing. That was the amendment from the First Amendment complaint that the relators relied on to say, now I can prove intent. Because they must have known, because of what these other people were doing at a later point in time, that something was wrong. And frankly, that does not, number one, they now admit that letter had nothing to do with this particular study. So that, why those allegations are in the complaint, Second Amendment complaint, is frankly puzzling. And with even with or without those, there again is no specific false claim alleged here. The only payment alleged is this initial payment.
Why isn't it sufficient to allege that accurate and truthful certifications were material to continued receipt of payment on the grant?
Because you have,
in general terms,
Your Honor, you have to take the next step. This is not a case where you have an affirmative misrepresentation that goes to the heart of a particular grant. For example, there was the Abtec case, which referred to minority business enterprises, and the person or the entity that filled it out was not giving money to the minority business enterprises or the business, which went to the heart of it. However, for the certification issue, and as the cases have discussed, you've got to look at what regulations supposedly were violated and whether violation of those regulations is material to the funding decision. There's nothing in the Second Amendment complaint that says that those regulations that are allegedly were violated would have changed or were the primary factor for deciding whether or not money should be awarded. In fact, if you look at the way that these grants work, the loan policy cited by the relators, there's a system in place for dealing with regulatory violations. It's not a, you violate a regulation, give us our money back, you get no more money. It's not a slam dunk. The government funding process would grind to a halt if we turn the False Claims Act.
Yeah, but what if you certify compliance with regulations?
Your Honor.
And that certification is false, and then you get money. That would be a false claim. I mean, I understand your argument that they didn't allege that they got any money after their false certifications, but if they did, if the false certification was submitted in order to help them get a further installment, why wouldn't that be a perfectly good allegation?
Because, Your Honor, again, you have to look at what the false certification, if there is a false certification, what is the regulation that supposedly was violated that you lied about?
Do you think the government pays people when they submit false certifications merely because what is certified is an unimportant regulation? I would think once the government discovers you are falsifying your certifications, you don't get any more money.
Well, Your Honor, if you look at the Lammers case, at the time they renewed that grant, the government knew that the entity was not in compliance with the regulations of the government program.
Had they submitted a false certification saying they were in compliance when they knew they weren't in compliance?
And the government continued
Did they know they were not in compliance and they nevertheless certified that they were?
I believe that the facts of that case as reported indicate yes. They knew as well as the government
so
knew.
So in other words,
it goes to a question of, again, materiality and whether that violation is what the payment is conditioned upon. There are no allegations here that the one payment, amorphous as it is, was conditioned upon compliance with these regulations. And I see my time is up. And if no further questions, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Mallon.
Thank you. Very briefly, Ron, I want to address just a couple of points that were made. The regulatory scheme here is one that requires self-reporting. And
we know that. But did you actually allege anywhere that there were subsequent payments rather than?
Your Honor, we have alleged that the study continued, and the FDA letter certainly shows the study continued after the immediate period of time Dr. Gross was in it.
And yes, of course. But did you get installment payments?
Your Honor, if the study continued, installment payments had to have been requested and taken down. They do their financial services requests.
Well,
how do
you know you didn't get the $3.7 million all up front?
Because the regulations do not permit disbursement in that fashion.
Why didn't you allege this in your complaint?
Your Honor, I think that were we repleting this, we've learned a lot about
again?
What might may have made it more clear. But,
Rule 9B is quite specific. You have to allege, you know, the who, what. So why couldn't you just allege in your complaint they falsely certified compliance and as a result obtained another installment payment?
Your Honor, I think what we attempted to do is allege that they falsely certified compliance and that the study continued, which supports the inference that they certainly continued to request funding because of the nature of the funding vehicle.
Well, it may support an inference, but you're supposed to plead these things.
Well, Your Honor, part of the issue that we face in this case is that since discovery's not commenced, many of the documents that will reveal exactly what they did are in the defendant's possession.
But the only important thing you're trying to say to us is that there were false certifications which induced the government to continue making installment payments, but you didn't actually allege that.
Your Honor, I think we have, in effect, alleged it. We could certainly have been more clear, but I think we have, in effect, alleged that continued payments were sought and received as the study continued. And we saw with the FDA letter, finally, exactly what happened once the FDA, after filing of our complaint, commenced an investigation. And that investigation continues today with the OHRP letters that we have cited to in our briefing, and which we think the court can take judicial notice. Last point, if I may, this case is quite similar to the false certifications that were made in the Cantekin case, because it was in a so-called Form 2590 where there was a failure to disclose the additional funding from the same drug manufacturers whose drugs were being tested in that study, that the court determined a false certification had been made, because it was plain that the issue of additional funding was material. All these regulatory violations are equally plain in this case and material, and so we think that we have adequately alleged for Rule 9b and other purposes a false claim, false certification, and that the government's payments were conditioned upon those certifications, and consequently the government's been defrauded. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mellon. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.